entertain a motion to approve the agenda?
I spoke.
Is there such a motion? Is there a second? Thank you very much. Then
I know it's nothing here.
Consider the agenda as approved. So that takes us to the minutes of our last meeting. We'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes from our December 1st meeting. That was our first. Thank you. Second? That was our first of three work sessions that dealt with revenue issues and ridership issues on that side. So thank you. The minutes are approved as amended. Now I'd like to introduce the major item on the committee's agenda today. For the second of the Finance Committee's three work sessions on the fiscal year 2018 budget, staff will review and provide additional information on personnel costs, a very big element in the expense side of the authority's budget. This follows last month's session on ridership and revenue, and in 2 weeks we will have a special Finance Committee meeting to discuss non-personnel expenses. Following the work session on the budget, Mr. Anosecki will update the committee on the FTA's decision in late December 2016 to end the ECHO restrictions on FTA reimbursement of grant funds to the authority, and he will discuss and give us some idea of any implications for cash flow for the authority through 2017. So having set the stage, I will yield to Mr. Anosecki and Mr. Webster, welcome you to the committee's deliberation in 2017, to be as fruitful as it has been in the past.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, before we begin, can I ask a procedural question? Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right, since this is a work session, for my purposes, are we going to be able to just take in information, or are we going to be able to make suggestions, recommendations? How's this work session operationally going to work?
Relax. It's coming through.
What?
Keep talking, please.
No, I just want to know, is this an informational work session, or is this to be amended, or?
The only limitation of the work session is the subject matter, which is on compensation and issues related to compensation, like overtime and benefits, pension benefits, and other health benefits, things like that.
So members of the committee could make recommendations and?
Since the members of the committee are the members of the board, absolutely.
Okay, just wanted to clarify. Thank you.
You can tip it, you can make suggestions, you can pontificate, whatever you choose to do as a member of the board. Thank you.
Since
you joined the committee.
Yeah, thank you very much. And since this is my maiden voyage here, a quick question for you. Are you going to let these guys just present before we start peppering with questions so we can get through the presentation, or how are you going to do it?
They have a presentation that they will make.
Should we wait until they complete their presentation before we start asking questions?
Okay,
just procedural question.
In addition to the slide presentation, right, there's also a series of questions that have been proposed by various members, and there's material in your materials that provide the questions and the answers to those questions by staff. So, Mr. Anosecki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning to the committee. Whereas, if I may start with your comment on FTA's action with respect to ECHO, I will like to report, as the general manager advised the board, that on December 22nd, FTA sent us a letter formally advising Metro that it has been taken off of ECHO restrictions with respect to grants issued effective 2015 federal fiscal year. That decision was the culmination of, as this committee saw, significant effort on both staff, management, as well as the FTA itself in trying to walk through the set of issues that led to that initial decision in 2014. And we are very excited. And since that advice from FTA, we've actually drawn a significant amount of money from FTA almost immediately. And but we're doing it consistent with their counsel, with their directions, and with the in full compliance with the protocols. Now, that decision is for respective prospective draws and reimbursements. There's still a significant amount of unreimbursed federal grants that we're working with the FTA with the FTA in order to get those reimbursements. If you recall, that amount was almost close to $600 million a couple of years ago. We've worked it down to about $300 million, and we're developing for the general manager plan that will allow us to recover almost all of those funds. That's his direction to us, and we're working through that, and we'll keep this committee and the board advised as we make progress on that front. One thing, though, that I would like to point out is that this is not a windfall. The settlement and the recovery of past reimbursement does not create additional resources for this organization. It does not close the budget gap that we're dealing with, and it does not address the future needs for capital projects. It simply goes towards, again, paying for things that are already spent and helping us to some degree to reduce the outstanding lines of credit.
For the benefit of our public at large and our friends in the media, I think it would be useful if you just explain what ECHO, restoring WMATA's ECHO status means, and what have been the impediments that WMATA has suffered under for the last, 18 months, 24 months, that it's been under this restriction and the ability to use the ECHO system.
Essentially, what this decision by FTA means is that just like every other transit agency in the country, now we have the capacity to draw funds once expended within 3 business days of that payment. Prior, under ECHO restrictions, what it meant was that for us, we had to obviously pay our vendors as they provide services to Metro, and then assemble all of the documents, review all of the contracts, and then ship those to FTA for their review and approval before they will open up the process for us to get reimbursement. Because of the complexity of some of the projects, the timelines involved, the quantity of documents involved, it took weeks and months for some of these decisions to be made. And obviously, given the fact that FTA is reviewing it, using a third-party vendor, obviously there are times with questions and responses which added to that timeline. So the significant difference here is that, you know, we can access those reimbursements essentially within 3 business days of any payment versus 60 to 90 days before getting reimbursed for prior payment.
And the difference between accessing those funds in 3 or 4 business days as opposed to 60, 90, or 120 days required WMATA to then dig into its lines of credit and actually the GANS notes. And could you just summarize how much we were required to use our lines of credit in order to make up for this time gap?
The ECHO restriction process obviously costs us money in several ways. One is what you just described, the fact that we were denied immediate use of those funds and therefore had to approach the capital markets to draw on our line of credit, which at this point is at $250 million, but at some point it was almost $500 million in terms of line of credit. We've worked that down again, given all of the things that we're doing. But there was also an additional cost. And this is the cost of assembling those documents, reviewing those documents, shipping to FT, and then having those conversations, which during this timeline cost us close to $10 million, as I've told this committee in the past. So it is a significant move on FTA's part, and obviously we're grateful that they've made that decision, and we're working to make sure that we can get back to where we were before.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Question. Does any member of the committee have any questions on that before we move on to the FY18 budget work session? Seeing none. Gentlemen.
With respect to the FY18 budget, following the general manager's operating budget proposal in November, staff received about 50 questions seeking clarifications and additional information on the budget itself. And as the chairman mentioned earlier, this has been broken down into three conversations. The questions and answers with respect to personnel budget were provided to the committee as part of today's materials. Our goal today is to review the elements of the operating budget and then to respond to the questions the committee may have. Personnel expenses, as you can see from this slide, make up 71% of Metro's annual operating budget. Within the personnel budget itself, salaries and wages represent about two-thirds of the total personnel cost. Again, you can see that on the breakout slide, Additional elements of the personnel budget, as we all know, include health care, pension, FICA, as well as workman's compensation. Overall, personnel costs will decrease year over year by $27 million. About approximately $27 million, exactly $26.5 million, with salaries and wages going down by $30 million, again, due to the elimination of 1,000 positions, both from the management actions as well as from the proposed service reductions. As the committee will see later, the savings from management actions and service reductions are partially offset by the impact of using the lower amount of federal grant funds for preventive maintenance. But among the personnel costs, as you see here, over time will go up to help support Back to Good initiatives, although management will continue to look at efforts to reduce overtime across the organization. There's also slight increases, as you see there, in healthcare, pension, and workman's compensation, based on either market factors or actuarial projections. And we can get into some of that a little bit later today. Slide 5 shows Metro's personnel cost trends since 2014. As we noted in the past, these trends reflect additional bus and rail services, the adoption of a fatigue management policy, and the expansion of both capital program as well as compliance activities. The decrease that you see in FY18, again, is tied back to the 1,000 position reduction, adjusted again for the preventive maintenance funding level reduction. On slide 6, you see Metro's, again, total expenses along with the various components. I think what's notable, and I think you see this across the nation, is that the ratio of base salaries slash wages, as well as the fringe benefits, including healthcare, pension, workman's compensation, and others, remain relatively constant in terms of their composition of the personnel budget. Again, year over year, Metro's personnel budget, as I said earlier, will go down by about $27 million. And this includes, as you can see from here, about $42 million coming from the elimination of the 700 positions that the general manager embarked upon prior to the proposal to reduce service. An additional $24.5 million in savings will be achieved if the board approves the general manager's proposal to reduce service, along with associated, which will result in the elimination of additional positions along with associated costs. And then, of course, this savings will be adjusted, as I mentioned earlier. But overall, it will reduce the personnel budget from $1.3 billion in FY17 to $1.288 in FY18. And the committee has seen this slide before. Again, it shows the trend that I've spoke about a little bit ago and the decision in FY18 to reduce 1,000 positions, which results in an 8% reduction to total positions for Metro. And on slide 9, focusing specifically on the right sizing of service, we provide a breakdown of, between bus and rail of how that's distributed. 60% or $50 million of the reductions will be coming from Metro Bus, with about $9.5 million coming from Metro Rail. And in terms of positions, 184 in Bus compared to 116 in Metro Rail, leading to the 300 positions that will result should the board decide to approve the proposed budget. The last three slides focus on WMATA's pension and post, other post-employment benefit liabilities and ongoing contributions. As the pension committee has heard several times, Metro's long-term unfunded pension liability is $1 billion as of the last actuarial valuation. which translates to about a 78% funded ratio for Metro's five pension plans. In FY18, Metro will contribute $151 million to the pension fund, again, based on actuarial projections. And again, that projections were reduced slightly as a result of the proposed reduction in the number of positions. With respect to OPEB, similar to the pension fund, the OPEB has a liability. In this case, it's $1.8 billion. But unlike the pension plans and obligations, Metro has no funding set aside for OPEB liabilities. And therefore, Metro pays all of its OPEB liabilities on a pay-as-you-go basis. The projected OPEB cost for FY18 is about $60 million, although the general manager has recently, as you're aware, taken steps to try and reduce those costs. But until and unless a trust is set up, Metro will continue to pay these obligations on a pay-as-you-go basis. And given the funding gap that Metro was dealing with in FY18, there is no recommendation in the budget with respect to setting up a trust. Finally, there are several approaches in terms of addressing this, and again, the committee has seen this slide in the past. The example on slide 12 discusses or suggests a pre-funding, again, in this case, starting with $5 million and graduating to about $40 million a year, which would then start throwing off both assets and investment income that will ultimately reduce the future liabilities for OPEB. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation. I'll be glad to respond to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Adesaki. I think the process that we'll use is that the chair, I'll begin with a question, and then we'll just go around the room starting with Ms. Harley. Everybody can then just ask one question at a time or make one comment or kibitz for 5 minutes if that's what your desire is, and we'll go around the table until we've either gotten hungry for lunch or exhausted questions. So let me start with the slide in the beginning. I think it's slide 4, operating expense budget. And this slide shows that there's a $27 million personnel savings. Here we go. Yes, $27 million personnel savings from FY17 to FY18. And this incorporates the reduction of 1,000 positions, both as a result of management actions as well as what would result were the board to approve the reductions in service and fare increase being proposed. Now, here's my problem. The average compensation is probably about $100,000 to $123,000 per LaMotte employee. And so to use a simple example, let's keep it, be conservative, that's $100,000. 100,000 times 1,000 positions is $100 million. Yet you're only showing a savings of $27 million. So the question is, what explains why the reported savings is only 25% of what a reduction of 1,000 positions should yield?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are several factors that play into your calculation and the numbers that we see here. I will start with the base assumption, which is that all of the positions being reduced reflect full value. As you know, when we construct the budget, we do not fully fund all of the vacant positions because, as you know, it takes time to recruit, and obviously depending on how much resources is available, you can dial that up or down depending on how you want to approach that. But essentially, on average, each vacant position reflects about 25% of the value that's budgeted. So that reduces the amount significantly. Now, if you go back, even before you get to that point and say, if you saw in one of the slides I showed you that of the 700 positions being reduced, 90 or so positions were in capital, so you have to extract that out also. And You then add on the fact that with respect to the preventive maintenance, you shifted back into the operating budget an additional $40 million of cost that was not there last year. In the aggregate, lead to the fact that I know you will not see and should not expect $100 million savings from a reduction of the size that we're talking about, given these set of factors.
Okay, so let's just take those two factors. You've got 92 positions that aren't really reflected in this operating budget. So is the value of those 92 positions, 92 times roughly $100,000, or what's, you know,
no,
what's the amount of money?
The same calculations were applied to all of the positions. What I was alluding to is the bucket in which those savings are credited. So those ones will not be credited to the operating budget. They will be credited to the capital budget. With respect to the operating budget, the numbers is $42 million, as you'll see on slide 7. From the elements of that 700 positions that are in the operating budget.
Right. I understand conceptually the problem. I'm trying to get a number that goes with the 92 positions so I can sort of work back the arithmetic and figure out how we got from what should be a savings of $100 million to only a savings of $27 million. So is there a number that you can assign to the reductions of the value saving of the 92 position reductions in the capital budget?
Yes, we can assign a number. I just don't have that number here with me, but yes, we can assign a number to that. But what I was pointing out with respect to this slide 7, is that the $42 million relates to the 608 positions that are for the operating budget, because the conversation is about the operating budget. And the 92 is for the capital budget, and those are not included in here. But I can get you a number for that.
And also, you talked about the discounted value on vacant positions, so what's the mathematics of that? What's the arithmetic of that? How many vacant positions are there that you've discounted?
Of course, that's a moving target, right? But of the initial 500 positions, close to 300 of those were vacant positions. Again, I mean, the goal here is not to, I mean, it's to, as much as possible, be humane in the process. So we work with the department to try and move with positions and plan in terms of retirements and folks that are leaving so that we don't have to lay off. The organization does not have to love too many people. So about of the initial 500, about 300 or so were vacant positions, but we're walking through the rest of those numbers, and again, as to the extent that we can minimize layoffs, that's the GM's goal. If we can't get there, obviously we'll go through all the processes. So, and with respect to any vacant position, again, depending on when that individual is leaving, you will not be able to, because these positions are not vacant for the entire year, you will not be, we shouldn't expect to get 100% of those salaries.
Thank you. I just want to make sure we've got 1,000 people who are going to lose positions or positions that are going to be reduced from the budget. And I just want to make sure that we're getting full value for these reductions in terms of the FY18 budget and the demands being put on riders in terms of fare increases and service reductions and the jurisdictions in terms of the higher subsidy request.
Okay, thank you.
I want to come back to your preventive maintenance number there, but I want to follow my own rule, and so I'll yield and see if, as we go around, begin with Ms. Harley for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. I just had a question. If you can go back to slide number 4. The overtime rate for 2016 dropped in 2017 to 77, and it's back up to 81. Can you explain why that is? And if you can provide which departments that project their need for overtime and whether or not they're safety related?
You're correct that the actual overtime expenses in 16 was actually higher than the budget. And that was intentional because we were evaluating several options to reduce overtime. And as you know, there's a relationship between overtime and the number of full-time positions. But we can, as Excuse me. And so, as I pointed out earlier, for FY18, we're actually going back to the FY16 actual levels, which means if you actually factor in overtime and inflation and things like that, wage adjustments, it's actually still below. It will still below what the actual will be. But we will provide you with information, the departments where the overtimes are occurring and what's driving them.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Corcoran.
Yes, thank you. And I'm going to address this to Paul as compared to Dennis. And Paul, on these numbers, and I know a lot of it is right-sizing the staff. How confident are we in the right-sizing formulas that we are using, and how are we exactly getting to those numbers? It can't be just dollars and cents related.
No, it's not. I mean, it's taking a look at the functions that we do. So, for instance, the sales offices, for instance, we looked at, you know, what part of the customer base that we're serving with that, does that make sense? And that's why we did what we did there. We looked at vacancies, the time of vacancies, for instance. And if a spot has been vacant for so long, then maybe it was time to move on, and maybe for whatever reason, either we can't get that in the marketplace or we don't need it as much. Maybe it's not as high of a priority. So it was a combination of all those factors that we looked at, and that's on the sort of the 700 portion of this. On the 300 portion is tied to service. It's directly tied to that. So it wasn't just a numbers exercise, but clearly it was in reaction to numbers and just the reality that of what we're facing. So then what is the logical process we'll use to deal with that? So that's how we've done it.
Ms. Carmody?
Thank you for the presentation. No questions at this time.
Ms. Costa.
Thank you. I think heard in prior discussions, non-budget related discussions, that we're using contractors to deliver some of the work that WMATA has to get done. And I've been looking at public agency budgets my entire life, and I always try to push to understand how we're getting functions delivered, including contract costs, because sometimes when we look just at personnel costs, we're not really looking at the overall cost of people doing the work. And so can we get some information as far as boots on the ground that we're delivering through contract services also, just to get a better understanding of the overall people doing WMATA work?
We will provide that to you, sir. Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Lobby.
Thank you. You know, as a member of the pension subcommittee, along with Mr. Bolger, we're very concerned about both the pensions and the OPEB non-funded liabilities. And I believe your report shows for pension, we have a $1 billion non-funded liability. And for OPEB, we have $1.8 billion. And that the only way we've been handling these issues is by paying them as you go, and I believe the numbers are $151 million for pensions that have to be paid out of the budget, and $60 million for OPEB. Is this typical the way these types of benefits are handled long term, or are these amounts, this total of $2.8 billion, is this something that we really need to be concerned about?
You are accurate that Metro has $1 billion of pension liability and a $1.8 billion OPEB liability. With respect to pensions, I believe I noted that there is a trust, and most of the immediate payments to retirees come from the trust. The $151 million that Metro will make for FY18 is what is actuarially determined to make to as a contribution by Metro with respect to those future obligations. So each year, Metro is required to put in money into the pension plans, along with the investments which collective together should fulfill Metro's obligation to its employees. And most of the other government agencies have a pension trust that address that, and it functions the same way. And at 78% funded ratio, it's relatively there. Again, the jurisdictions are, some are higher, some are lower, but 78% is not bad. Obviously, you want to eliminate that obligation if you can. With respect to OPEB, some jurisdictions, again, there's no trust for OPEB, and some jurisdictions with similar liabilities, frankly, have set up a trust to fund it. In this case, Metro has no trust, and therefore we are funding that as pay-as-you-go basis.
Okay, and certainly that was a recommendation out of the pension committee, and I'm sure that Mr. Bulger will follow up on that. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Corcoran actually took my question, but I do have another one. Dennis, have a point of information. The C-suite and the senior executives, Office of Communication, the Government Affairs, where are those salary expenses accounted for? Are they in a more detailed presentation, or are they spread out through the different buckets? How do you account for those figures?
All of that information is in here, and when you look at the budget binder,
the more detailed,
More detailed by department across the enterprise.
Thank you.
Thank you. I remember a figure that we got some time back, and I went and looked for it again. I couldn't find it. It was a cost per unit of service that we that Metro had versus other transit systems, and ours was somewhat higher. I can't remember. It was cost per passenger, cost per something in terms of operating, and ours was higher than other transit systems, than most other transit systems, if I remember correctly. Okay. And I guess my question is, if we reduce our headcount, as has been proposed, do we have a sense, and you may not know this right now, do you have a sense of how we would compare with other transit systems in terms of our cost per unit of service?
Yes. The information you're referring to, is McKinsey shared some of that, but it's also collected through NTD, the National Transit Database. And yes, as your cost goes down, obviously you have your cost per unit of service also goes down. Again, as I mentioned, and as I believe as McKinsey mentioned when they presented to this committee, you have to take all of those numbers with a grain of salt. Based partly on the ways they are reported and all of the other factors, the uniqueness of the various systems, as well as the actual cost that's being measured, because sometimes they measure based on ridership, which was, again, the focus that McKinsey was dealing with when he came here. Obviously, when you're measuring on ridership, when your ridership is going down, your numbers will, your ratios will be relatively.
But my question is there a way for us to recalculate that, assuming
yes.
the reductions in headcount that we are proposing in this budget?
Absolutely. Can recalculate that and provide it to you.
Just for clarification for me, you got this $40 million on the preventive maintenance adjustment. If we put the $40 million back on the capital side, would we be able to take the entire $40 million off of the current deficit that we show on this budget?
Yes.
Mr. Bulger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can we go to the OPEB slide with the, as Bob was talking about, that has the trust idea? And again, I just checked the minutes. This is FYI information only. So I want my colleagues to look. If we start investing in a trust, in 10 years we bend the line. The green line starts to go down. Let me say that again. So if we start putting money into a trust for our retirees' health and insurance, et cetera, fund, the green line starts going down in 10 years. So every year we wait, the red line keeps going up. So it's my intention, Mr. Chairman, to, at the appropriate time, to, as we discussed on our conference call the other day, to make a recommendation that we fund the trust per my discussions with our CFO in the District of Columbia. I'd add one other procedural question. I know I'm breaking the rules, but it's important. And Jim, Mr. Corcoran, look, the $151 million that comes over for the pensions, okay, in our conference call for our meeting on finance, I didn't know where that amount came from. Does that come through our auditors through your committee and then gets crosswalked over to finance?
They verify that the money is applied correctly. Technically it would come through operations. It would come through from the various jurisdictions if there in fact was that money.
No. My question is it's my understanding that our auditors get information from our pension trustees that then roll up a number, and this year's number is $151 million, and then it goes into space, and then boom, it ends up in the finance committee's lap. So your committee doesn't have any relationship to our auditors?
The relationship, but the question was, does the money come through there? And it's actually the audit committees of the various pension funds, I believe, that we're referring to.
Clarification would be very helpful.
The various pension committees,
right.
The various pension committees, obviously, as you know, have actuaries and auditors and accountants that review those books. Part of the job that the actuaries do is to estimate the anticipated or the expected contributions by management to those funds each succeeding year. That information is provided to us, to the finance office.
Our auditors don't have any.
No, they do review it as part of the financial audit each year. If you recall, as your memo indicates, they will get a copy of that. They will review it to make sure that those numbers are accurate or relatively reasonable. That's their job. For us, they don't, obviously, I mean, we use the information then to project the budget for next year. And as I indicated this year, we've made some adjustments based on the fact that there's 1,000 positions that will not be there that they've assumed will be.
Mr. Chairman, what do our auditors say about this number?
Just as a follow-up on that, what was that annual contribution for the green line to turn like that? I remember we tried to set up a $5 million.
It starts at $5 million a year. You double that until you get to $40 million and just keep it at 40 for the next.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry.
No, fine. And this is a fixed liability. So, you know, we've terminated medical benefits for the employees. So the only question of the two lines is how to get to the end point.
Except for the police, yeah.
And Mr. Bolger, your committee, when we had this discussion, your experts were going to provide some information on how other transit properties dealt with this post-retirement health benefits, as well as to how jurisdictions in the tri-state area dealt with them. I still haven't seen that report, and I won't have the broader committee take up this issue until your consultant provide that information, because my recollection was that they were saying that a lot of properties around the country deal with it just as Vermont is dealing with it currently on a pay-as-you-go basis. So I think we need to be educated and informed with that information before we take it up at the full committee level. Thank you. Ms. Hudgens?
It's easy to jump in because you can trail around different questions now. I want to go back to Mr. Augustine's question. And so you have indicated that the shift in the capital piece when normalized to the next budget, is that what your response to this question?
I believe Mr. Augustine's question was if this board chooses to shift the $40 million back to capital,
mm-hmm.
will that reduce the expectations for jurisdictions? And my response was yes.
Okay. And
any segment thereof. Correct. That's correct.
Right. Okay. So that there is no variance there. And I think that's the challenge that we faced in saying where this budget is today and what our needs will be as we continue to normalize our operation for the future. And so I think it is a yes for today, but the question is what happens on each end of those budgets. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I just want to cite the source data that informs this question. It's page 8 of 8 in the questions that were sent to management. And although the source of the information is related to workers' compensation, the nature of my question doesn't have to do with workers' compensation. So the information that was provided to the board indicates that in 2007, we had 10,748 employees, and that employee headcount supported about 28 million labor hours. So the nature of my question has to do with this issue of right-sizing. By 2015 and 2016, the number of employees had gone up to 13,000 in 2015, 12,836 in 2016 on a per-employee basis. Look at the labor hours that you guys have provided. We're talking about the employees in 2015, 2016 were working between 215 and 278 hours less than the employees in 2007. That's between 5 and 7 weeks of labor. So I guess we either had kind of runaway overtime in 2007. We may have runaway absenteeism in 2015, 2016. But that's a really big swing on a per employee basis. So it'd be good to know what's going on there. 5 to 7 weeks of labor. So we have either a big productivity problem or a big attendance problem or a combination of both. So I think it would be helpful to get a better understanding of what is the right size of this organization and what are the levers to ensure we're getting the value for the personnel costs expended.
We will undertake the analysis that Mr. Dumjo's requested and provide the response to the committee.
Will you be able to do that by the work session at the end of the month? So we can finish that issue at that point? Rather
yes.
Is that satisfactory? Mr. Rossi?
Sure. Yeah, one of the benefits of going last, I don't have to ask a question, but I can make a couple of comments. So just regarding the last one, I think the chart was also pretty provocative to me, Mr. Dormsjo, and you referenced this 2007 demarcation point. You can also look at 2014. The sort of ratio remained relatively stable up until then, and I'd always presume it was the employee fatigue initiatives and those other things which sort of shifted that curve a lot. But I do think it warrants further conversation and discussion as to whether or not we've gone too far, whether there's a better balance that we can find. A couple of other comments. You know, Mr. Bulger, intellectually, I think there are very few people. Well, he's gone, so his issues about pre-funding OPEB, I don't know if there are very many people who disagree fundamentally that that's the more prudent way to go about doing it from a financial management standpoint. But the elephant in everyone's room is that there is a big ask being made of everyone next year and whether or not we can afford it. And it's not just looking at next year. You know, the 5 million increment that's being asked for next year, yeah, we could all make it work. But then it's 10 million each additional year for the next 7 years. And we're looking at big operating and capital asks that, quite frankly, I'll only speak for my jurisdiction, but I suspect it's true for everyone, we're wondering how we can make that work. So it's less an issue of whether or not we should do the OPEB pre-funding, but whether or not we actually can, given all the other issues going on. And then the other point, one of the questions that I had asked that you responded to in writing were what would be some additional actions that you could take if you needed to reduce the management's savings more? And you talked about it in terms of personnel reductions, but you didn't speak to the issue of shifting more of the preventive maintenance costs. And I'm curious as to, I guess I do have a question, but you don't have to answer it today. I'm curious as to the thinking as to whether or not we shouldn't move beyond that number that you've recommended, or there's some other reasons that drive your thinking about further reductions only in terms of personnel.
I can just have a general comment on that. I mean, that was, the recommendation was based on what I had heard from the board over time, that they wanted to move away from, in effect, funding operating through some of the capital program. And that's what drove that decision. But, again, that's a policy decision for the board to wrestle with.
Speaking only for me, I'd love to hear your professional recommendation, given how we are in this issue of trying to figure out how to make it all work, whether or not that is something that should be a source of savings that we look to, if not today, soon.
Yes, just to follow up, both on the broader issue as well as on a follow-up to the specific issue, we assume that after the public hearing at the end of January, the general manager will be coming back with some revised budget, or at least budget that takes into account both some of the things at the public hearing and some of the things that you've heard from board members. So we'll have something a little different sometime in early February to attract. Now, just dealing with the preventive maintenance issue, just following up on Mr. Augustine's point, that this is the slide that says 26.5 million savings in personnel. And just to inform everybody what these numbers mean, you've got the preventive maintenance adjustment, what you call it, at 30 million. Now, I assume the number 40 is arithmetically arrived at by taking the 100 million that was in preventive maintenance in the capital budget in FY17. And the 60 million that has been recommended by the general manager to be in the capital budget for preventive maintenance in FY18.
Okay.
And therefore, the difference to that, the 100 minus 60 is 40. Now, since that's in the capital budget, the implication is that this is a preventive maintenance activity. And since we're talking about it in terms of compensation, that suggests that this has to do with personnel. Can you perhaps describe what is the activity or what are the job functions that we are moving, you know, that we have taken out as preventive maintenance under the capital budget, and what would we be proposing to do in the FY18?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The activity that is performed here is maintenance on buses. So the preventive maintenance transfer in FY17 is a combination of personnel costs for maintenance of rail cars and maintenance of buses, the actual vehicles themselves. What the general manager's proposal includes moving the bus maintenance activities all back to the operating budget. Now, it's the value of bus maintenance activities is much greater than 40 million. This is just the component that was funded in the capital budget in FY17.
That's what I was trying to get at. So what we're talking about is essentially bus maintenance technicians, or people that...
Mechanics, yes.
Mechanics, so to speak. And so that it's not as though in FY18 we don't have 100 million or 80 million of this cost that we could continue to fund in the capital budget. Is that correct?
The level of activity of maintaining of buses is staying the same. What this change is a change in how that activity is funded.
Right. We're not reducing the level of bus maintenance activity.
Correct.
So if, as my proposal from late last year were, that we only go from a more shallow slope from 100 million to 80 million in FY18,
The effect would be to change that preventive maintenance number to 20 million.
Yes.
Is that correct? And therefore, the variance, the amount of, quote, savings would actually, that number would actually be much higher. $20 million.
As long as there's an equivalent amount of money in the capital program to pay for that.
Thank you. Ms. Harley? Ms. Corcoran? Ms. Carmody? Ms. Costa?
A quick question. Well, actually, first, contract dollar information that I asked for, you've already given to us. But I would like some more information on what functions it's supporting. You've given us the raw numbers. On workers' comp, it's a small amount of money, but we're showing a pretty big increase from 16 to 17, over 20%. And we're not showing an increase from 17 to 18. And I know we're talking about the 18 budget, but what caused the big jump from 21 million actual to a 17 number of 26? I'd suggest that I have some experience managing workers' comp programs for relatively large agencies, and I'm not quite sure how we're managing it here, but other folks have found that cases weren't necessarily managed as comprehensively or as deeply as they might have been managed, and when that happens, the number tends to go down. So it'd be interesting to hear how you all are looking at that.
I agree totally, and it's a focus of mine in upcoming year, as well as absenteeism.
Mr. Price,
yes, yes, I am. The staff data shows that the operating budget headcount relatively flat from FY 2015 to FY 2017. My question is, how many additional operating staff were required for the opening of the Silver Line?
Is there a second?
I don't have any information.
You can come back to me. Okay. Because I'm very interested in that. The second item, Dennis, in terms of staff that works on capital projects, the labor costs regarding that, do you roll that into the overall capital project? That's one of the ways to, you know, recapture some of those dollars. Is that currently being done?
That's correct.
Okay. Are we also looking at our policies regarding how we capitalize things and maximizing the capitalization of any activities that we can to reduce our operating costs?
Yes, we are, and that's, again, part of the use of federal funds was, again, to that extent, as long as we're being accurate and fair in terms of our financial reporting, but yes, we are maximizing the use of capital assets to reduce operating costs.
Okay, thank you very much. But I am interested in that data if you get back to me.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to respond to Mr. Dorsey's comments. I think he's absolutely correct. You know, we have lots of priorities, and the OPEB pre-funding may not be the biggest priority. But I wanted to point out that this has been discussed long before I got here, back in fiscal year 2015. And I assume that's the budget year, but it's been passed on fiscal year 2015, 2016, 2017. Now we're in 2018. And to me, it's not a good practice to not address these issues when we have an opportunity. We got in trouble with maintenance of track through deferred maintenance, and to me, this is a financial deferred maintenance. In that, if we don't start addressing these issues that we know are issues and have known are issues, we don't have to start addressing them. Then this problem will just get bigger and bigger and bigger until it becomes an emergency. So that's just something I want to put on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dennis, with the Back to Good, Safe Track, and FTA requirements, looking at some of these numbers here, what's the trend in the use of contractors, and what are the escalation and costs there? I assume there are some, but I'm sort of curious about the magnitude of that.
Right.
And again, maybe that's something you get back to us, but in general, I assume the trend is up. Yeah.
It is, and you will see that in the non-personnel conversations that we're going to be having next, but we can provide you those information ahead of time.
But in general, is it quite a steep spike?
We are attempting in all possible ways to maximize efficient delivery of services, and that includes leveraging external service providers where we believe it makes the most sense.
Thank you.
I want to follow up on Mr. Costa's question about workers' comp. I agree with the suggestion that we need to better manage the workers' comp program. We also got a suggestion from our auditors that we also needed to do a better job of anticipating and projecting costs, budgetary costs, for workers' comp, and I want to know if we're addressing that also.
Yes, that was part of the latest review by OIG, and we've responded. We've made some changes, that we're discussing internally, which is, again, part of the GM's focus on workman's comp, how those services have been delivered, how we're managing cost, and trying to reduce absenteeism.
I just wanted to comment in terms of the question regarding OPED and retirement. I think we all understand that we are shifting in terms of reliability, safety, and those things, and that those are going to be investment pieces. I don't disagree, and I think all of us have gone through these cycles in our local governments as well as here in terms of how do we get to a point of a consistent, reliable piece. But I think that the challenge that we always face is that consistency and reliability is very hard to nail when you talk about government and local agencies. So I think that we're talking about the right thing, and the question I would just want to make sure is where will our commitments be in 2019, 2020 when we say we're back to good, and that what things belong in the packet with back to good, because reliability and safety have to be the pieces that make up the organization. And so that's going to be the piece that we can make that commitment to the employees as well, I would hope.
Yeah, my question has to do with slides 4 through 8. So the way this information's presented, we have the actuals from 16, the budget from 17, and the proposed for 18. So it's very hard to kind of unpack where we are and what's going on, because we don't have a forecast for 17 against the budgeted 17. And given that we've had SafeTrack, the suspension of late night service, a very dramatic ridership decline on Metro Rail and an ongoing headcount reduction. And wouldn't it be better for us to have forecasted 17 or at least, you know, we've got 6 months of data on 17, actuals on 17. I know there's some seasonality to all this, but are you guys not doing a forecast for 17?
Mr. Domshu, we do a forecast for 17, and in February the board will see both the quarterly financial forecast and a sense of where we expect to be at the end of the year.
We don't have that. We can't do that now. I mean, it seems it's like putting the cart before the horse.
No, we.
How about this? How about this? How many? What's our head count today? You can get back to me on that.
Of course, I can get you that information. I mean, I don't have that in front of me at this point.
But we can go back to the previous quarterly statement and the quarterly projection. We'll just go back to if you want that one first, and then we'll have the next round because we do it quarterly. All right. That
let's be clear what you're saying. You're going to provide for the half year that's been completed?
Yeah, but the December 31st. The last quarter that we performed, which had a projection for 17 for the end of fiscal year 17, okay, so and then we're coming up with the next round of that.
6 months, and then yeah. Project for the full FY 17.
Yes, yes.
That's good. Okay. And we'll have that early in February? Is that
We'll give you what we have now because it's existing, and then the other one will come out when we do the normally quarterly update.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Mr. Dorsey.
Good.
I just wanted to follow up on Mr. Costa's question on the contract services because you did provide some information for that in response to question 8, and I just wanted to see if that informs our discussion a little bit, that we can get a little bit out of you now before having to wait for it. What was shocking in your response to that is that you showed that contract services have gone from basically 24 or 25 million in FY 15 to 64 million projected for FY 18, which is, I guess, a 200% increase. Now, is the contract services numbers here equal to contract labor numbers, or is this all contract services or just contract labor?
Can you?
Yes, this is the response to question 8, page 23 of 29, page 4 of 8.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead, sir.
So my first question is, the question was about contract labor, but the information is described as contract services. So the first question is, are these the same? Are these all services, contract services for providing labor?
No.
Okay, so this includes all contract services. So this would include engineering services and legal services as well as just contract labor.
Right, paid from the operating budget, correct.
Okay, but the question was in terms of use of contract labor.
Right, but obviously these contract services reflect contract labor that are providing services for Metro. Again, there's a broader group of services that are provided to Metro that are provided by contractors, right? From the operating budget, that's what this referred to. But as Mr. Costa has indicated and has requested, there are other contracts. The entire capital program, for example, is all by contract labor. So those will be provided in response to his question. But this goes to contract services in the operating budget.
Right. So this includes more than just services for replacing the track inspectors or the University of Tennessee contract for those kind of people.
That's correct.
So are you able to tell us what are the top five? So we have this, I assume this includes Parsons Brinkerhoff, and this would include engineering services and –
Again, to the extent that those are in the operating budget, they will be included in here. But a typical example will be the audit services. We have some contracts for obviously for the financial system. I mean, all of those things that will be reflected as part of this particular category.
Right. And so what accounts for the big increase over the last two or three years? Why the great growth of contract services over the last two or three years? You know, what is this related to? Is this a function of the SafeTrax program, or does it relate other projects and other activities as well?
This all of the above. I mean, we can show you how that has grown. If you recall, I mean, again, part of the response that we're providing with respect to the non-personnel piece that lays out what's driving these series of increases. Again, I mean, as Metro is maintaining, again, you know this better than I do, but obviously each year the infrastructure gets a lot more older. It costs you more. There's inflation. There's all of those things in addition to the fact we're actually doing more to try and respond to both SafeTrax as well as back to good.
Yeah, but those things have been in the capital budget. You've got here a big increase in the operating budget. Let's try and get the information as to who are the contractors and if you can break them down in some way between engineering services and labor services. And do you have any other ideas, Mr. Costas?
My earlier question, what I was requesting is sort of an overview by function. I mean, it's about delivery of what WMATA needs. And I think these guys are going to get back to us at a relatively high level what functions these dollars are being delivered. Because I think if we start to talk about, you know, contract personnel, we're going to confuse ourselves because this is about WMATA getting a function provided by a contract, which includes people and other support functions. And if we dive too deep into this, we'll be here for the next 10 years. But if we get a high-level functional cut, I think we'll be in good shape.
And Mr. Chair, that was what my question or comment was trying to get at as well, just that top line sort of overview to give us some sense of, because I agree with you, that spike in that answer really wasn't an answer.
I had one more question, I'm sorry. Just following up on the pension issue, where the pension number is the $151 million, and you provided the data on the actuaries of the various plans as to what they had asked for. My question is, once each of the individual pension trustees, actuaries, requests the number of what they think is needed for the contribution from WMATA for that year, what review does management and staff undertake that those requests for contribution are reasonable and consistent with basic or standard or best accounting and actuarial practices? Look, we've got a big chunk of money here, $151 million. We don't have any ability to oversee that number. The only oversight of that number is going to be whatever management does to verify that that number is reasonable or is consistent with some standard actuarial practices.
So I believe I mentioned earlier that those numbers are provided to WMATA's external auditors who review that and provide their judgment. Beyond that, WMATA has contracts with each and every union that establishes how these numbers are determined, and we comply with that.
Okay. How does WMATA's actual consultants provide that information to you? Is it orally or is there a written report in which they have a finding that the contribution requests are reasonable and follow standard or best accounting and actuarial practices?
It is part of, to the extent that they have any issues with that, they will provide that as part of the management comments. But as you know, we do have regular conversations with the auditors on an ongoing basis, covering all aspects of WMATA's financial reporting, including the numbers that go into to make up those reports.
Right. If there's some auditor's comments or actuarial consultant's comments as to the reasonableness of these requests for contribution, I'd appreciate
that being provided, or at least being put in the resource material for the board so that we can exercise our oversight function and come to the conclusion that these numbers are reasonable.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. But part of the work of RSM, the external auditors, is that to the extent they have any find any issues with financial reports or documents, those are provided to the audit committee, which obviously will share that with the rest of the board.
Not necessarily, as Mr. Price has pointed out. The audit committee has some different functions and responsibilities than the finance committee. So to the extent that that could be provided to the finance committee directly, that would be appreciated. Thank you. Any other questions, last-minute questions, issues, comments?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like that report to go to the pension committee as well. It's what I was asking for before when I was trying to have a conversation with the chairman of the audit committee.
Very good.
My understanding is that the materials that are provided to audits go to the entire board as a matter of course.
Tell me where it is. That's great.
Board members are asked to accept the audit reports. So that is a standard procedure. So they are presented to all board members.
All right. Well, I think that completes the business for the Finance Committee for today. As I said, we will have a second budget work session on January 26th on non-personnel expenses. Having no further business to come before the committee.
Michael, would you recognize me? Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. Everyone's attention for one moment. This is a request for the executive session. In accordance with the bylaws, I, Jack Evans, request that the Board of Directors convene an executive session to discuss the following topics pursuant to Article 2, Paragraph 9, Subsections B, litigation, investigations, and other legal matters, C, personnel or labor issues, including discussions of labor contracts and labor negotiations. F, safety and security matters when premature release would compromise public safety. And H, development of WMATA position or strategy on pending or proposed federal or state legislation. So I'd like to move this at this time. Is there a second? Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed? The ayes have it unanimously. The motion passes. We'll see everybody upstairs as soon as possible.